And we're going to continue the discussion on abortion and post-abortion care now in Senegal. I'd like to introduce Siri Sue. And Siri is a PhD candidate in socio-medical sciences at Columbia University. She worked on post-abortion care in Senegal as a University of Michigan population fellow. So, Siri, please.
Thank you. Operations research on post-abortion care, or PAC, from around the world has yielded an impressive set of best practices associated with improved access to and quality of care. These include the replacement of dilation and curettage with manual vacuum aspiration and misoprostol, training midwives to use PAC technology, and offering family planning services during or after PAC. Perhaps the greatest strength of the PAC intervention is its underlying ethos of treatment, irrespective of the origins of the abortion or the legal status of abortion. Yet this literature rarely addresses what it means from a professional perspective to treat complications of abortion in a context where abortion is prohibited. In this paper, I will share some practices related to PAC in Senegal, where abortion is forbidden under any circumstance. I argue that these practices are best understood when situated within the context of Senegal's abortion law. I have no disclosures to make. Now, the World Health Organization estimates the rate of unsafe abortion in West Africa at 28 per 1,000 women of reproductive age. This is less than the estimated 36 unsafe abortions per 1,000 women in Middle and Eastern Africa, but far greater than the 6 unsafe abortions per 1,000 women in developed regions. There are few data, national data, on induced abortion in Senegal. However, epidemiological data from hospitals suggest that this is a major public health problem. A study of 4 referral hospitals in the capital city showed that nearly a quarter of patients admitted with complications of abortion had had an induced abortion. The government of Senegal introduced post-abortion care in the late 1990s to address abortion-related mortality and morbidity, and PAC is now available at all levels of the health system. Senegal's abortion law prohibits induced abortion under any circumstance and subjects those who procure abortion to imprisonment, fines, and loss of professional license. The law does not require medical providers to notify the police if they treat women who present with complications of induced abortion. The severity of the law, however, may lead some providers to believe that they are obligated to report. And my review of the Senegalese press found that some providers do indeed notify the police when they encounter such cases. Now, my findings are based on an ethnography of Senegal's national post-abortion care program conducted in 3 regions of the country over a period of 13 months. I conducted in-depth interviews with 89 individuals, including medical providers, Ministry of Health officials, and personnel from NGOs and donor agencies. I also observed PAC services at 3 hospitals around the country, and at each of these hospitals, I reviewed and documented data from PAC registers. And I also conducted an archival review of abortion using medical, social science, media, and legal sources. So what happens when a woman arrives at a state hospital with complications of abortion? Providers triage women according to their clinical state upon arrival. Those in a state of shock are treated immediately. If the patient is stable, providers question her to establish a standard medical history. During this line of questioning, known as the interrogation, providers also seek sociodemographic information such as age, profession, and marital status. They conduct a clinical exam and, if necessary, an ultrasound. If there is no suspicion of induced abortion, providers treat the woman and she's released. If suspicion of induced abortion emerges, providers question the patient further. If she admits to procuring an abortion, providers may notify law enforcement. Otherwise, she is released. Now, my research suggests that most cases of suspected induced abortion treated at hospitals are neither documented as such nor reported to the police. My review of post-abortion care registers in 3 hospitals between 2009 and 2010 indicated that most abortions were recorded as miscarriages or spontaneous abortion. Now, for the next few minutes, I'm going to describe some of the practices deployed by medical providers that result in women's release rather than arrest. Medical providers in the study were generally very supportive of post-abortion care as a maternal health intervention. They insisted that they did not discriminate between patients with complications of miscarriage and induced abortion. Their foremost priority was to treat the patient even if they suspected induced abortion. In spite of this discourse on the imperative of treatment, my research suggests that identifying induced abortion was an important part of PAC. Providers considered three primary forms of evidence in the differentiation between miscarriage and induced abortion. This evidence fell along a spectrum between suspicion and proof regarding the type of abortion. On the far left appear social and behavioral patient characteristics that initially raise suspicion, such as marital status, profession, and even presence or absence of family members at the hospital. Among these characteristics, providers unanimously pointed to marital status as the main characteristic eliciting suspicion. And suspicion of single women reflects broader disapproval of abortion as indicative of sexuality, inappropriate sexuality outside of marriage. Moving further to the right of the spectrum, we find physiological indicators offering stronger evidence of induced abortion, such as infection, hemorrhage, objects in the body, or cervical injury. The woman's admission, located at the very end of the spectrum, represented the third and ultimate proof of induced abortion. Only when a woman confessed to having attempted induced abortion did providers record the case as such. Without the admission, providers recorded and managed such cases as cases of spontaneous abortion. If suspected of induced abortion, however, women were subject to further questioning. One midwife explained how suspected women were retained for surveillance in case of police involvement. "We keep her here until the police come if it's an admitted or probable induced abortion. We tell each other until the problem is resolved. We have to keep an eye on her. We cannot let her escape. She needs to be watched. Sometimes these women escape. You come in on your next shift, and they're gone before anyone notices." Now that we've explored the calculus of evidence in differentiating between induced and spontaneous abortion, let's take a closer look at how providers actually record abortion. This table offers a month-long snapshot of data from the 2009 PAC register at one of the hospitals, and I've classified abortion cases into two main categories: cases in which the patient admitted to inducing abortion in red, and cases that providers recorded as spontaneous abortion in gray, but would likely have been considered suspicious. I compiled the latter cases by drawing upon the spectrum of indicators that I described earlier. Now, we see that providers use a variety of terms to describe abortion, including late abortion or incomplete abortion. In one case, the type of abortion was omitted. However, providers explain that any cases not explicitly marked as induced were by default considered to be spontaneous. During this month, there was only one case of admitted induced abortion and at least seven cases of possible induced abortion. I now share an example observed during fieldwork at one of the hospitals that illustrates further how suspected patients are managed as cases of spontaneous abortion and eventually released. A woman who self-identified as married arrived with a high fever and bleeding after 2 months of amenorrhea. She reported not knowing that she was pregnant. She took a concoction, her words, to relieve a headache after a disagreement with her husband. The attending providers felt that her story did not add up and that she had likely self-induced the abortion. Yet they treated the woman and released her the next day. In spite of suspicion regarding the circumstances of the abortion and repeated interrogation, they recorded the case as incomplete abortion in the register. The following quote from a midwife offers insight into why such cases might be recorded as miscarriage. "Sometimes the midwife will say it's a spontaneous abortion when it's an induced abortion. There are implications for the provider if the case is pursued by the police. It's rare for the provider to write induced because you have to prove it and you can't let the patient go after treatment. It's just easier to write spontaneous abortion." So if providers obscure induced abortion, why do they attempt to differentiate between induced abortion and spontaneous abortion in the first place? By investigating the type of abortion, providers protect themselves should the police inquire into a case. Described by a midwife, the following scenario illustrates the importance for providers of knowing or at least being able to demonstrate that they attempted to determine the type of abortion. I heard that some of the midwives were called to the police station in a case of suspected induced abortion. The police asked them questions. Finally, they saw that it was a case of spontaneous abortion. The patient doesn't always tell you. You always have to know what you're doing, otherwise you're not covered. You have to do complete exams and in-depth interrogations. In conclusion, the post-abortion care model calls for non-discriminatory treatment of complications irrespective of the origins of abortion. My research suggests that medical providers in Senegal actively attempt to differentiate between miscarriage and induced abortion. Consequently, women suspected of induced abortion may be subjected to extensive questioning and retained at the hospital following treatment. These practices must be understood within the context of the law, in which providers who treat complications of abortion believe themselves to be vulnerable to charges of complicity in illegal abortion. At the same time, this perceived legal threat compels providers to obscure suspected cases in hospital records. In turn, national health information systems are unable to account for this practice, making reliable estimates of abortion nearly impossible. The absence of abortion data further perpetuates the notion that women who seek induced abortion are deviant and fall outside the boundaries of acceptable sexual behavior. And this is what abortion scholars refer to as the prevalence paradox. The legal context of abortion thus engenders a particular set of practices related to treating complications that entrench the social stigma of abortion for women and the medical professionals who treat them even further. Thank you.
I love the presentation, and what I'm going to ask you about is actually not the primary purpose of your presentation, but I was really struck that on 8 admission cases, 2 of them were defined as molar pregnancies. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about whether you think that's true or whether you think that there's something else that's going on in terms of how these cases are being recorded.
With respect to molar pregnancy,
what is the usual incidence of molar pregnancy?
Much lower.
Much lower. Not 25%.
No, not even so.
So you think it's an excuse?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Is molar pregnancy being included in this in some way to try to have some of this legally protected stuff because it's such a rare?
Yeah, my question is similar. So you can help prove it.
Was it an attempt to mimic spontaneous abortion, to mimic induced spontaneous by giving like misoprostol or something that could cause bleeding to make it spontaneous abortion and then they continue to do the evacuation?
Well, misoprostol is available in certain pharmacies. I believe it's currently in the process of being registered formally, and Marie Stopes International is behind that process. Some medical professionals did suggest that post-abortion care was part of a larger circuit between private and public practices. So medical professionals in private practice would initiate abortions with misoprostol or other methods and send women to the hospital for follow-up treatment.
The molar thing.
She may not know.
I'm just curious if you have a read on that because it's really striking. It could just be a one-off.
Because molar is an ultrasound diagnosis. You have to show it by ultrasound.
Right. So molar pregnancy or detecting and treating molar pregnancies were an important part of discourse around post-abortion care. It was post-abortion care was seen as a way of catching and treating these cases. I can't really address your question, but I will say that, when I asked some medical professionals about molar abortion, in fact, I asked why those cases were in the post-abortion care register to begin with, and quite a few of them suggested that a molar pregnancy or abortion didn't necessarily rule out the fact that it was an induced abortion. or that it had been
induced. Yeah, but that would be indicated. That won't be like something illegal. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
I think there's something really fascinating there that I think is totally fascinating.
Okay, we have two comments here. Yes, stand up, please. Policy relevance of research. Anybody can talk. Let's just get the other question on the table that was to this presentation, and then we'll have a broader conversation.
Hi. The situation around manual vacuum aspiration, I unfortunately didn't have the time to address it in this presentation, but that's certainly one of the chapters of my dissertation. Manual vacuum aspiration technology is available in Senegal through the post-abortion care program. It is highly controlled by the Ministry of Health. It is not part of the national medical supply chain. So medical managers who want to renew an MVA kit, instead of going to their local pharmacy depot, have to go to the capital city and have high-level Ministry of Health officials sign off on their request before they can legally obtain or appropriately obtain the kits. So I would imagine that obtaining an MVA kit for a medical professional would entail going outside of the public sector, going outside the public sector, ordering it online, purchasing it during travel abroad. Medical professionals and Ministry of Health officials suggested that they were available or that people were using them. There's just I couldn't find any numbers on how prevalent it is.
Thank you. So we have about 5 minutes for general questions. We have one general one. I guess one thing I wanted to ask you, Angel, you put this together. A lot of the countries focused on here are Muslim countries. Were you looking for, as a program chair, were you looking for comparisons and contrasts on the religious angle as you put us all together here, or not particularly? Are there comments about, we had the Sunni-Shia discussion a few minutes ago, are there other comments about how Islam is sort of playing out differently in Indonesia, Egypt, Jordan, Pakistan, Senegal, Lebanon is mixed. I know, that's why I didn't want to say that they're all Muslim countries, but.